For the questions today, please come line up at the mics. Make a question very short and concise. And we hope that everyone gets a chance to ask a question. Thank you.
Roger.
Roger Leisner, Radio Free Maine. Back in 1988, up in Maine, the Maine Democratic Party and their platform adopted a plank recognizing Palestinian statehood. Now, this was a result of the Jesse Jackson campaign, and it was the only state in the nation that the Democratic Party did that in. 2 years later, AIPAC came into Maine and just worked their buns off to repeal that part of the platform. Now, it's funny that within the last 5 years, I haven't heard much about AIPAC. Has it sort of gone out of style, or has the fundamentalism in Israel sort of driven it maybe into the peace camp?
Well, first of all, I think, let me make a suggestion, and that is there's a very strong temptation. In fact, we're trained for it from infancy to sort of project problems somewhere else. You know, somebody else is a bad guy. We're not doing it. The fundamentalism isn't in Israel. It's here. Most of the problems are here. It's easy to blame somebody else, but it's harder to look into the mirror, and that's what you ought to do. AIPAC is less visible than it was before, but that's because the Clinton administration has moved so far to the extremist end. In fact, when Clinton came in, the Israeli, you know, the early first year or two, the Israeli press was amazed. They said, you know, for the first time, we've got an American president who is to the extremist side of our own extremist parties. You know, in fact, they started joking about him as the last Zionist and stuff like that. As U.S. policy has drifted towards a more extremist position, AIPAC it's still there. It does what it did before, but it doesn't have to be as visible. Because it's, you know, maybe we're certainly right in the mainstream of the Democratic Party. As far as the main proposal, the one you mentioned in 87, that's right in the mainstream of American opinion. I mean, polls have been showing for years that roughly 60 or 70% of the population supports Palestinian state. Now, one of the great failures, in my view, crimes of the PLO, and there are many, is to fail to make any effort to make use of this fact. I can run through the history if you want, but plenty of people, a number of people here, who were sympathetic to the Palestinians but didn't think much of the PLO, and I'm one of them, were trying to convince them for years that they should try to do what every other third world movement does, namely help support some kind of popular solidarity movement, which will make use of the fact that most of the people support them anyway, even without knowing anything. And they flatly refused. They don't have anything to do with it. They acted in such a way as to make it as hard as possible to build up solidarity movements. As a result, that's one of the reasons why these things have happened. As I say, there's plenty of blame to go around. In this case, the state of Maine's position was consistent with polls throughout the country, but of course not with policy.
Hi. Wait a minute.
Let's just switch up and back between the mics.
I have two quick questions. One of them is not necessarily related to the Palestinian issue, but I was just curious because I noticed you mentioned like then Soviet Union a few times in your talk as Russia. Is that a particular reason why you use Russia as opposed to Soviet Union then? But the second question also was in regard to U.S. support of Israel, and you say that United States supports Israel because Israel is a client state, which I agree with that, and you disagreed with some thinking particularly from maybe Arab world or Middle East region, I guess, that support of Israel is due to Jewish lobbying here in the United States, and you so disagreed with that, and I was really interested in that, you know, why you disagree, because, well, we see so many examples of that. The latest thing was Hillary Clinton, for example.
The latest thing?
Hillary Clinton in New York rejecting money from, you know, some Arab groups, or, I mean, there are so many different examples, but I was just interested in more.
Yeah. Well, the reason why, I mean, you know, during the period when, right now, there's no Soviet Union, okay? That collapsed 10 years ago. So now there's the Russian Federation. if you want to use the technical term. During the period when the Soviet Union existed, it was run by Russia. So you can call it Russia or you can call it the Soviet Union. It doesn't matter very much. As far as the Jewish lobby is concerned, well, I gave one reason. I was talking about the very common claim in the Arab world and, in fact, in writings of American Arabs, namely believing that the U.S. permits Israeli atrocities because of the influence of the Jewish lobby, and I think that's just a flat-out error. I think if you look more broadly, you see that there's nothing unusual about this. Same thing happens elsewhere. The U.S. has, in fact, happily tolerated worse atrocities by Arabs, like Saddam Hussein, without any Jewish lobby. This is a misunderstanding of the nature of terror and aggression. As far as other things are concerned, yeah, there's a Jewish lobby. There's domestic lobbies on all sorts of things. But I think it misunderstands American politics to think that domestic lobbies based on communities have all that much influence. I mean, they can have a swing influence. Like if there's an issue on which the main centers of power in the business world don't care very much, you know, like should you recognize the Armenian Holocaust or not, then, yeah, domestic lobbies can make a difference. But when there's an issue on which the business world is united, they don't make much difference. And the case of Israel is kind of interesting because here's a case where the real powers in the country have in fact been split for the last 30 years. There's been a divide. So there's been a sector of power in the United States, which is an important sector, and with regard to the Middle East, a very important sector, namely the energy corporations, which have more or less favored the international consensus. And they oppose state policy on other things, too. So, like, they would like to have a reconciliation with Iran, and they're opposed to the fact that the government won't allow it, and similarly on Iraq. On the other hand, there's other sectors of power, big sectors of power, which have gone the other way. And in this kind of a context, it's possible that a swing factor can work. But I don't think it's the Jewish lobby. The Jewish lobby is part of it. But after 1967, there was just a love affair with Israel on the part of a large sector of the elite American population. American intellectuals, for example, just fell in love with Israel. You can see this very easily just by looking at the coverage in even left journals, you know, let's say Dissent, Social Democratic Journal. It's a good. Up until 67, they didn't care about Israel one way or another. I mean, in fact, the New York Times wasn't all that pro-Israel. It wasn't, in fact. It was non-Zionist, Jewish-owned, but non-Zionist. A Commentary magazine, which is now kind of like a rabid ultra-Zionist journal, back in the 1950s was so critical of Israel that the American Zionist Organization actually set up a competitor called Midstream to sort of represent the Israeli point of view. All of this stuff changed in 67. And it changed because of Israel's military victory, which won them a lot of points. For one thing, they were giving a great gift to American power. For another, the other is a little more subtle, maybe, but you have to remember what was happening in the United States at that time. The United States was fighting a war in Vietnam, and it was not succeeding in crushing the South Vietnamese, who were the main target of the attack. Despite what they now claim, educated Americans, the educated population, the elite population, pretty much across the spectrum, was pro-war and very upset by the fact that the U.S. wasn't winning. They had many had what they called pragmatic objections, like Kinsley, you know, it's costing too much or something. But fundamentally, they supported the war, and that continued until 1968 when the business community turned against it. And then later, intellectuals turned against it. But Israel was showing how you deal with third world upstarts properly. Kick them in the face, you know. And they won a lot of points for that. In fact, those of you who are old enough to remember will recall that the jokes about the let's send Moshe Dayan to Vietnam and he'll show us how to do it right. That, among other things, led to a quite substantial shift of opinion in the articulate sectors of American society, including the media. And that gave it, you know, starting from then, there was quite a different picture. And there were other sources. So, for example, one of the main sources of support for Israel in the United States is a very powerful group, namely Christian fundamentalists. they're a huge part of the population, you know, way beyond the Jewish population. I mean, about, you know, 40% of the population. This is one of the most fundamentalist countries in the world, you know, more than Iran. You know, like around 40% of the population call themselves born-again Christians. And every political candidate has to pretend to be some kind of born-again Christian, otherwise you can't run. And that's a very substantial group of people. And, there's a big sector of that, which is very what they call pro-Israel. I mean, they may be anti-Semitic, they probably are, but they're very supportive of Israel. And the reasons are all kind of complicated things about the Book of Revelations, and, you know, I won't go into that. But that's a big support group. There are others. So, yeah, there's a Jewish lobby, undoubtedly, and it has an effect in things that don't matter very much. But when it comes to a crunch, I think you see that it doesn't have that much power. So when there have been occasions where where there was really a conflict between Israel and the United States, several. There haven't been a lot, but there have been a few such occasions, and it's interesting to see what happens to the lobby. So one such occasion, striking one, was in 1956, when Israel invaded Egypt along with France and England. And the U.S. was opposed to that, not because it had any objection to invading Egypt, but Israel had the wrong allies. Those are the guys we're trying to kick out of the Middle East, France and England, and they're trying to reinsert themselves. The timing, Eisenhower didn't like. This was right before the election, 1956 election, the most sensitive moment in political life. Eisenhower just told Israel to get out, period. Okay? He said, you get out or else. And Israel got out, of course. The lobby disappeared. No protest from the lobby. Another event like that, minor event, happened just a couple of years ago in 1991 there was a confrontation between Shamir, who was then Prime Minister, and George Bush over the style of settlement. It had nothing to do with substance, but over the style of settlement in the occupied territories. Shamir comes from there's a westernized section in Israel. It's mainly the Labor Party. Educated. The Labor Party is educated professionals, western-oriented, secular, that sort of thing. And they understand how you deal with the West. They understand the norms of Western hypocrisy. There's another sector which is poor, religious, the Arab-Jewish population, Sephardic Jews and so on. They don't understand much about the West. Shamir and Likud generally comes from them. That's why the U.S. typically prefers the Labor Party. They do about the same things, but the style is different. That showed at that time. So right at that moment, every time James Baker, Secretary of State, would show up in Israel, the settlers would pick that moment, to go up to a hill somewhere and put up a sign saying new settlement and saying, some vulgar expression about Baker, and we don't care what you say. And the U.S. didn't like that. That's not the way you're supposed to behave. The way you're supposed to behave is the way Shimon Peres would do it. So you wait until a week after Baker goes home, and then you don't go up and put up a new settlement. You expand, you thicken an old settlement doing exactly the same thing, and you don't offend the boss. And everybody's happy. The boss continues to pay. That's fundamentally the difference in the Labor Party and Likud. And Bush and Baker were annoyed enough at this so that Bush threatened to withhold the loan guarantees, which were being used illegally by Israel to build settlements. Israel was very much upset about that. There's a lot of money at stake. The lobby at first protested, but Bush made one speech on television, which he didn't say very much. He just couple of hints that this wasn't going to work, and the lobby just vanished, and Israel backed off. This just happened a couple of months ago. The Israeli government was deeply committed. A big project of theirs was selling advanced military technology to China. Now, they have mostly a military industry. It's kind of military-based economy. It's kind of like the United States in many ways, sort of an offshoot. And a large part of the economy is military-based. And for their purposes, these advanced technology sales to China were extremely important. and the U.S. was opposed to it. Barak insisted publicly in China, in Israel, he was going to do it. He didn't care what the United States thought. But the Clinton administration just told him, sorry, that's not going to work. And, of course, they had to back off on a matter very critical to them, and the lobby was not in evidence. You know. And I think you find that in case after case. If the lobby sees that it's running up against real power, it's going to disappear. For one thing, because they're cowards, and for another thing, because they don't have that much power.
I would like to ask you to elaborate a little bit more on the issue of Jerusalem. You already mentioned that has been used to divert the attention for what's going on in the settlements and with the infrastructure in the territories, but it seems that in some way the peace process always falls back on Jerusalem. In the Oslo Agreement was treated separately from the rest. The present Intifada started from something happening in Jerusalem, or it was used as a focus, because as you were saying, the holy sites are there, and major interventions are happening on the physical form of the city, and this is upsetting the situation. So what do you think will be the role of Jerusalem in the peace process?
Well, first of all, we have to be careful about what we mean by Jerusalem. If you mean Jerusalem in the pre-1967 sense, okay, that's a small area. I mean, the first thing Israel did when it, after the 67 war, was to expand, approximately tripled the size of Jerusalem very quickly, in both into the West Bank and also into Israel proper. Israel semi-annexed Jerusalem. Technically speaking, it was careful not to annex it, because it knew that would lead to an international protest, but it's called annexation, and in practice it's kind of like that. So they tripled the area, and they more or less annexed it, but not formally. They didn't do it in a very polite fashion either, so it's recently been revealed in Israel, only in the last couple of months, that when they came in, they smashed up a Palestinian housing area right in front of the what's called the Wailing Wall, the western wall of the temple, and they barely warned the residents, and it turns out that the bulldozers apparently killed, bulldozed people right into the houses as they smashed it down. But they basically took over a large part of the city. That's expanded Jerusalem. Now, then it goes on. There's also something called Greater Jerusalem, which is a big ring, around it, which is intended to incorporate the city that I mentioned, Ma'al Adumim, which itself goes, its borders go to about 8 kilometers from Jericho. Most of these settlements only use a tiny fraction of the territory that's assigned to them. So Ma'al Adumim, for example, which is the most important because it splits the West Bank in two, east of Jerusalem, that uses about 1/16th of the land assigned to it, either in housing or agriculture. That means they're intended to expand. Well, when, say, Rabin talked about Greater Jerusalem, that's what he's talking about. So to distinguish the issue of Jerusalem from that of the territories is not really very easy, because Jerusalem, what's called, Greater Jerusalem, is a big piece of the territories. In fact, it effectively splits the West Bank in two. One of the salients, there's another one further north, and there are a couple others. If you talk about Jerusalem proper, like the religious sites, in the old city and that sort of thing, that's not a hard problem. One very good Israeli sociologist, Baruch Kimmerling, very smart guy, Hebrew University, he had an article a couple of weeks ago in which he said, look, the issue of Jerusalem is a diversion. He says, this is the easiest. We could solve this one in 5 minutes, he said. Okay, that's a bit of an exaggeration, not quite 5 minutes. But it's easy to figure out technical answers to the problem of Jerusalem if anybody wants to bother. Like the holy sites can be under some kind of international supervision, and the Palestinian, what's left of the Palestinian residential areas can be Palestinian administered, which if Israel's sensible, they'd prefer anyway. A couple other things like that. It's really a kind of small technical problem. What cannot be finessed, however, is the takeover of the territories. That you can't finesse. Either they get out, or it's Bantustans. Those are the choices. And it's, although you're right that this intifada happened to start in Jerusalem, that's pretty misleading. I mean, it's been mostly in Gaza and around Ramallah and places like that, which is typical. The same was true of the last intifada. Does everybody know this story already, or do we have to sit here and listen to it?
Well, the story is that what we think is that U.S. imperialism has to be overthrown through workers' revolution, as opposed to you who offers criticism to the U.S. diplomacy.
For those of you who aren't
familiar
with this, this is a routine that goes on at every meeting. Let me just ask you, how many people want to listen to this? Will the people who want to listen to this raise their hands? Okay, will the people who want to go on with the discussion raise their hands?
Okay. Why are you against democratic discussion?
I just gave you a democratic vote.
I mean, you can manufacture your own consent.
Yeah, right. This is a standard routine of harassment, an effort to break up meetings that goes on all the time. Okay. Look, you set up a meeting, you're free to set it up, everybody can come. Let's go on. We had a popular vote. We've heard it already. Let's go on.
I just thought there were a few facts that you didn't mention, and I wonder why. For instance, if I go back to the 67 war, it's a fact that Israel was attacked. It was a self-defense war, and it wasn't mentioned. If we're talking about the Lebanon war, I mean, the life of the Israeli who lived in the Galilee were hell for years. Attacks and children in shelters, children murdered at schools, you didn't mention it. And recent things, like the killing in Gaza, which I'm against violence, and I don't justify any kind of violence, but the Gaza event in Netzarim, you didn't mention, and it happened one month ago, the school bus of Israeli children who went to school who was bombed by Palestinians, and this created the reaction. You didn't also mention what happened after the parade. I think it's a mistake to bring so many policemen when people go out from the mosque. But what really started, and I read it in the newspaper because I live here right now, it was when the Arabs finished praying, they just throw stones on the Jews who were praying downstairs on the west wall. I mean, you didn't even mention. I don't think that violence is justified, but I think that also the Jews in Israel have the right not to be murdered and not to live in shelters and not to live there. I remember myself in shelters so many years. I mean, all these events were not mentioned by you, even by a hint, and this is what bothers me.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right. I didn't mention the atrocities committed against Jews, and I didn't mention the vastly worse atrocities committed against Arabs. Like, in discussing this current intifada, I said I've heard nothing about the atrocities. So you're right. I didn't mention the few cases in which atrocities were committed against Jews or the many cases in which atrocities were committed against Arabs. And the same in the past. I barely mentioned them because I was talking about other things. However, and we could, but then we'll balance it. I mean, for example, it is simply not a fact that the Palestinians coming out of the mosque started throwing stones on the down below. And if you read Haaretz, you'll see that it's not a fact. That happened after the border guards were shooting.
Was the killing of the children who went to Netzarim, is it a true fact
or not? That is a true fact, as was
so
the...
Why did you choose among these two facts just to mention the fact that people were killed by the American helicopters, and you didn't mention the children
for a simple
who were murdered on their way to school?
For a simple reason, because the overwhelming mass of the atrocities are by Israel and the United States. I am talking about the United States and our supply of military helicopters. If we were providing guns to the Palestinians to kill Israelis, and the Palestinians were carrying out 90% of the atrocities, I'd talk about that. But I'm talking about our providing military helicopters to the Israelis to carry out 90% of the atrocities against Israel. That's why I mentioned it, but barely. Barely. But may I continue?
Sure,
I let
sorry.
You talk. Let's go back to 1967 and 1982. In 1967, Israel was not attacked, and nobody even pretends that. I mean, back at the time, Abba Eban, it was his job at the UN to claim that Israel was attacked. He knew it was a lie, and what he was saying was total lies. And you can't even get this in Israel.
Was Israel attacked in 73? No, in 72?
You want to go back to that? Let's take a look at 67. I'll come then next to 73. In 67, Israel launched the war. Now, you could say it was a legitimate preemptive strike, if you like, but there is just no question that Israel attacked. Okay? That is not even a matter of debate. As for 1973, no, Israel was not attacked. What was attacked was Israeli-occupied territory. Egypt attacked Egyptian territory that was held by Israel under the conditions that I described after Israel refused a peace treaty. And the fact of the matter is there is not one case in which Israel was attacked. In 1982, you've got your dates mixed up. There was a time when people were hiding in the Galilee, but not in 1981. In 1981 was an extremely peaceful year. There were no attacks from the north to the south, zero.
University and all the media, the CNN are in the territories, and you get all the information through the media. And you say there is no media, attacks on Israelis. We were in the shelters, and you stand here and said that there were no shelters, attacks on Lebanon territory.
No, I didn't say that. I said in 1981, up until the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, there were no attacks from the north. There were plenty of attacks from the south. Israel was regularly bombing Lebanon, trying to elicit some kind of PLO response, which would be a justification for the planned invasion. And they were bombing fishing boats, they were attacking villages, they were killing all sorts of people. There was nothing in response. Israel attacked in 1982, and they were pretty frank about it, because they were afraid of PLO moderation. They were afraid that the PLO was abandoning terrorism and was moving towards a political settlement. And that's what Israel does not want. They made it pretty clear. Like, if you were there at the time and you were reading the papers, you would have read it. Like in a couple of weeks after right after the invasion, Yehoshua Porat, who's, I'm sure you know, the leading Israeli, pretty conservative guy, incidentally, but the leading Israeli academic expert on the Palestinians, wrote an article in Haaretz in which he pointed out that we had to invade Lebanon because what was happening was what he called a veritable catastrophe. The PLO was refusing to carry out terrorist acts. They were becoming a kind of a moderate force for Israel. This is impossible. We want them to go back to terrorism. And Israel tried to elicit terrorism. Now, take a look at what happened after that. I mean, if you want, I'll direct you to Israeli sources. But right after that period, what was happening was regularly Israel was provoking attacks inside Lebanon. And when they would bomb somewhere in Lebanon, there would be a response in which Kiryat Shmona would get a Katyusha attack. That was happening consistently, and in fact, it mostly happened after 1982.
Why are attacks now when Israel already withdrew? It's not true.
Israel,
in the 80s, we were in the shelters. You read only the articles that serve your point.
No,
but
I don't.
Now are they now attacks on Israel when Israel withdrew from
fine.
From Lebanon?
So we agree, I presume, that everything you've said so far is false. And now let's look to the present. When Israel withdrew from Lebanon, let's take a look at the present case. Finally, Israel withdrew after 22 years of illegal occupation, in which it killed about 45,000 people, kind of triviality.
Nobody, of course, from the Israeli
A few dozen were killed in Israel. A few dozen counted up. And almost every case was retaliation for an Israeli attack in Lebanon. The standard cycle, there was a standard cycle that happened over and over. It's very well documented. The Israeli forces in southern Lebanon, the occupying forces in southern Lebanon, or their mercenary army, the SLA, would be attacked by the resistance, Hezbollah, and then Israel would retaliate by bombing northern, Beirut or, some refugee camp and so on, and then Hezbollah would send rockets to northern Israel. That was the regular cycle, almost invariant. And in fact, that cycle began in an interesting way. It began in 1992. Up until from 1981 right through 1992, there was almost nothing except Israeli attacks in Lebanon, of which there were numerous ones, like Shimon Peres's 1985 Iron Fist operations right in the middle of Lebanon were murderous. And they were well reported in the Israeli press, but there was almost no retaliation. In 1992, something changed. And it was described very accurately, for example, by Moshe Arendt, nice right-wing minister of defense. You know, don't have to worry about his politics. He explained that in 1992, the rules of the game changed. How did they change? Well, Israel had carried out an assassination of a Shiite cleric, and they killed him and his wife and child, and then bombed an ambulance that was trying to come pick him up. They said, well, okay, that changed the rules of the game. From now on, after this period, in fact, what happened is that what I just described, the cycle that after Hezbollah attacks on Israeli forces or their mercenary army, Israel would respond farther north, killing people, and then after 92, Hezbollah would also attack northern Israel. Now, if you go back to the early 70s, what you're describing is at least partially true. But after that, it's simply not true.
The Lebanon War, which I objected, was a reaction
These questions are very important.
It's a very important question. If you like, I'll be glad to give you, you know, the highest level Israeli sources which discuss and describe the Lebanon War. What you're hearing is probably propaganda that you learned in elementary school. Nobody believes this in the Israeli academic system. This is not true. I mean, the Lebanon War was a straight attack. Nothing had been happening except attacks from Israel to Lebanon for over a year.
We can only take two more questions, please. We will have to leave the hall
in
about
finished?
10 minutes. Please keep it concise, and we'll hope to answer.
Thank you. You had mentioned several, many events that didn't make it into the U.S. Mainstream press. And I was wondering if you could suggest some sources where someone in the U.S. could find out about those kind of things.
Well, you know, everything I've just almost, you know, not everything, but most of what I've just said is in, you can pick up off the web if you want. I mean, a lot of this I've written about in the last couple, the current stuff I've written about in the last few months. The earlier stuff is in a long series of books. I'm just myself, I've been writing about it since 1970 as the situation developed, just writing about it, and so have others.
I'm just curious, you know, where could I look now to be better informed?
You get a lot of material from the Hebrew. A lot of the Hebrew press is now available in English. So you can pick up a lot from, if you read good Israeli journalists like Amir Haas and Gideon Levy, unfortunately he's not well, so he's not writing, but Danny Rubenstein and a couple of others, and you can pick them up off the web from the Haaretz English edition. You get a lot of material. There are a lot of Palestinian sources. There are international sources. Read Robert Fisk, British journalist in the London Independent, and others, and you get quite good information. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch have had things. I mean, and there are many other people who write about this. I'm not the only one. But you're going to have to work. For example, on the one, I mean, I could have given 1,000 cases, but on the few cases that I mentioned, you know, the suppression of the diplomatic record, the current business with helicopters, you can find it, but you're going to have to search. The Boston Globe isn't going to report it. In fact, they made it very clear they're not going to report it.
Some foreign sources, foreign press that reports those kind of things?
Yeah, for example, the helicopters was discussed in the British press by a few journalists and in the Continental press. I mean, I don't want to suggest it's all that different, but it's somewhat more open. On the other hand, you're going to have to work. If you look up, if you're on the Internet and you look up ZNet, you're going to find almost all of this stuff.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, Noam. Having recently returned from both Gaza and the West Bank and seen these helicopters in action and seen sharpshooters, Israeli sharpshooters in action, killing kids. And by the way, this is reported in Haaretz, the main Israeli paper, but it's not reported here. I returned with this incredible sense of frustration, how to get the word out. I mean, it's this such a pall of silence here that we have to somehow be able to break. And I've talked there with people, you know, how can the international community somehow be mobilized to try to help break this silence? And we've discussed having an international presence, you know, which might command some kind of media attention if it can be large enough. One of the problems being people there cannot demonstrate any other way now except by taking rocks and having guns, because they will be shot down and killed if they are simply there demonstrating the way we do here, forms of civil protest. But they thought if we could get a large international presence to come and stand with them, maybe outside of settlements and so on, we could be some form of protection. I'd like your comment on that. And also one other thing I heard in Israel among the peace camp, which is being, in my view, you know, the silence that reigns from that peace camp is very, very depressing. But I did have people say, well, now that George Bush is going to be president, this was a couple of weeks ago, but they knew, things will be all right because he will put this matter on the back burner and America won't be so hands-on in its involvement. And if you could comment on that, too, I'd be grateful.
Well, direct involvement is a great thing, but, you know, it's extremely hard. There is direct involvement in Hebron, for example. There's a Christian, small Christian peacekeeper group in Hebron, which, since they're Christian Americans, the Israeli forces aren't going to kill them, you know, so they kind of leave them alone. And they publish regular reports. In fact, one of the ways whoever it was asking for information, their reports keep coming back from Hebron, but again, you got to get them on the Internet. But, you know, they've had some effect, you know, like the presence of some Americans tends to cut down the level of violence because, for the same reason I mentioned at the beginning, neither the United States nor Israel wants the terror to be too visible. Now, the same was true in Central America, incidentally. That was a real breakthrough in the history of imperialism, and we should be aware of it. In Central America in the 1980s, when the U.S. was carrying out a murderous war, primarily against the Catholic Church, in fact, but of course peasants are the ones who were mostly killed, for the first time ever in history, as far as I know, North Americans went down there to live in villages in the hope that a white face would cut down the level of terror, because they wouldn't want to murder people as visibly if there's North Americans around. Actually, they were coming from, a lot of them came from Christian fundamentalist groups. This is not coming from the left particularly. Witnesses for Peace, for example. That's an astonishing achievement. It's one of the most, you know, important events in the history of, that never happened in the history of imperialism. Britain, France, you know, U.S. and Vietnam, anything you can think of. And that was important, and it had an effect. But you have to think what the commitment is. I mean, you have to be willing to live like a third world person. Right? It's not so simple, you know. I mean, you can do it, and it's, I mean, they live like that, but that doesn't mean it's easy for us to live like that. We're used to a different level of privilege. And you're facing constant danger, and you're giving up the rest of your life. Yeah, it can be done, and it's extremely important, but it's going to be small scale. There is something much more important to do, which we can do right here, and that is break the silence here. You know, this has been done on issue after issue. I'm talking about the Middle East. It was exactly the same on Vietnam. It's the same on El Salvador. It's the same on Colombia right now. It's the same on Turkey. You know, you can run through the list of cases. A to Z is always the same. And it takes a lot of effort and organization and educational works and dedication, you know, to try to break through this. And over the years, you can do it. It is not easy. I mean, just to mention one case which finally hit the headlines, East Timor. I mean, I myself was working on that for 25 years, you know, very hard, writing about it, you know, speaking all over the place. So were a couple other people, so few that I could name them if you want. And this went on almost with no effect, you know, until finally there was actually one very good guy, Charlie Shiner, managed to use the Internet to carry out organization, which worked very effectively. Pretty soon there were organizations around and it broke through and so on. This is really hard work, no matter what the issue. And it doesn't happen just like that. You know, you got to devote yourself to it. A lot of time and energy. There are no magic keys. You just got to keep at it. And it's got to be done here. If it's not done here, it doesn't matter what the international opinion is. I mean, you know, Europe is marginal in this issue, most issues. The rest of the world can talk if they want, but the U.S. isn't paying much attention and won't unless they are disruptive. But right here, there's a lot that you can do. Here's the source of power. Here's where we are. We're privileged. That gives us an enormous range of things that we can do, but it, you know, it doesn't come cheap. You've got to devote yourself to it. As far as the peace camp in Israel is concerned, well, I don't have to tell you, but that term is used rather loosely. A lot of the people in the peace camp are kind of like American liberals. They want the Israeli occupation to work quietly without killing too many people. That's called the peace camp. I mean, I read a journal like, say, Israel Horizon, which is the publication of the Meretz Party in the United States. Meretz is the kind of, you know, end of the extreme dovish party. I just happened to look at their last issue a couple of days ago. I mean, it's the peace camp in the sense that the New York Times was the peace camp in Vietnam in 1969. You know, it's getting out of hand. It's too bloody. I mean, they deny everything that's happening, you know, and so on. We're very familiar with this. There are people who are authentically committed to justice, you know, and yeah, they would easily fit in this auditorium. And it's not all that different here or in other countries.
Breaking the silence. And what do you recommend in specific issues? What can be done to break the silence? From your lecture, you were talking about the important role of the army, of the U.S. taxpayer money that's going towards the military. Is there anything that can be done about it? Or is it a waste of time?
No, it's not a waste of time.
The other thing is the media. You talked about talking, and your talks have been very important to spread the news, but maybe there's some other strategy to tackle the media, to get to spread the word. And thirdly, what do you think about type of grassroots activism and how it's going to be mobilized into something effective? Because grassroots mobilization has been there for many years. The core issue is how do you get the voice heard?
Well, actually, the grassroots activism on this issue has not been here. I mean, I've also, Nancy has too, and others, been trying for 35 years to try to get some grassroots activism on this issue, and it has been very slim. As compared with other issues, virtually invisible, and as I mentioned in passing, the PLO has a lot to answer for in this respect. But the main problem is here. So grassroots activism is crucial, but it has to be started, and there's very little of it. As for the media, they know exactly what they're doing, you know. They understand what they're doing when they don't report that the U.S. Is providing more advanced military attack helicopters to Israel right at the moment when they're being used to attack civilians. They understand that. I mean, I could tell you personal examples of meetings with editors, if you like. But they understand that. We have to tell them. The way that they will begin to report it is if they are under pressure. But now we're back to grassroots activism and alternative media and things like that. Yeah, then they'll start to report things. Also, there are people inside the media who would like to tell the truth about it and can't because they need the backing of popular activism. It's kind of a reciprocal relationship on a lot of these issues. You know, if something gets reported, it helps organize. If there's organization, it helps people report what they know. A journalist can't expect to go too far and stay on. You know, it goes a little bit out of the required doctrinal limits, he'll be out, just like an academic for that matter in most fields. It's not all that different. But that's got to be the source of the work. There's never been another way to do it on any issue. Now, on the military aid, I think that's a point where you can really have an effect. I mean, most of the population. Huh. Yeah, overwhelmingly is opposed to giving military aid to Israel. But they have to know about it. You know, unless people know the kind of thing I was telling you, unless there's more than one opinion piece in the Raleigh, North Carolina paper in the whole country, you know, I mean, which is an astonishing degree of discipline if you think about it. I mean, that degree of discipline to be able to suppress crucial news like that everywhere in the country, that's a real tribute to the intellectual community. I mean, you know, Stalin would have been impressed by that. But unless that kind of thing can be broken, there isn't any hope. But on that issue, we have an open door. If people know that their taxes are going to send advanced attack helicopters to attack civilians, they're going to raise a riot. But they got to know. And in fact, the provision of military aid is one of the, I think it's, you know, it's a point that really ought to be at the focus of protest. I mean, you can, this isn't a matter of doing anything hard. It's just a matter of withdrawing participation. Now, it's withdrawing participation in atrocities. And that would have a tremendous effect, you know. And very hard to resist, I think, and if the news ever got out, which is why it's so suppressed. The same on the whole diplomatic record. You know, it's suppressed because if it ever gets out, people are going to be enraged. But it has to get out, and now we're back to grassroots activism. There's no other way than anybody's figured out. Actually, the availability of the Internet gives a lot of options that weren't around before and can be used pretty constructively, and is. There's an awful lot of information about these things going on around the few websites, including a lot of stuff from the Israeli press and from Palestinian sources and from international sources, like, for example, Bob Fisk, the guy I mentioned. And that material is very instructive.
I'm afraid we actually have to close the
talk. Oh, okay. Well, why don't we just finish these two?
If you can
okay?
be very, very quick.
Yeah.
Without making a comment, I think we can comment it. Thank you.
Yes.
That you talk quite extensively about the U.S. interest in the conflict, but you didn't really mention why Israel is still refusing the peace process. I mean, and refusing to give back the occupied territories, because the two reasons that are usually given for this is, first, a strategic military reason, but if you consider the gap between Israel military forces and its neighbors, it
they
doesn't
know there's no
really
security
stand.
Reason.
And the other is usually the question of water, but the United Nations just issued 2 weeks ago a report stating that giving access to water to everybody in the world would cost about the same as the ice cream budget of the European Union for 1 year.
That's
so what's
true, but meaningless.
Reason?
It's true, but meaningless. I mean, you could say the same about, you know, the cost of curing AIDS all over the world would be, you know, you wouldn't even notice it. Great powers don't behave like that. First of all, it's not true that U.S. is refusing the peace process. The U.S. has accepted, Israel has accepted the peace process as defined by the United States. You cannot accuse Israel of violating the Oslo Accords. They have not. They've lived up to the Oslo Accords, which were designed in order to allow them to do exactly what they're doing. And that's a U.S. policy. Okay? Now, why doesn't Israel want to... I'm just ask, how do they settle people in the territory? Are you Israeli?
No.
Well, if you want to know how they settle people in the territories, you should read the Israeli press. I mean, these people are subsidized. You know, they live better than people in... much better than people in the main settlements areas. I mean, they have... come on ads. These are like, you know, a lot of the West Bank is essentially suburbs of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You know, it's like people here who live in the western suburbs. You know, I mean, suppose you told people here, look, why don't you give up the western suburbs like, you know, Lincoln, Lexington, Concord, give back to the Indians. It wouldn't cost you much. There's plenty of places to live in downtown Boston. I mean, would anybody take it seriously? You know? I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with strategic interests or anything else. You know, you have something, you got something that you want by force, and you're going to keep it. Okay? Unless you're forced not to keep it. There's nothing special about Israel. We'd say the same thing right here. You know, I mean, how much money would it take to turn downtown, you know, say Roxbury into a livable place? I mean, so little that we wouldn't even notice it on our tax bills. Is anybody going to do it? No, that means giving up something, if you're a rich, privileged person and you've gotten something ultimately by force, you just don't give it up unless you're forced to. That's the story. We're very familiar with it. We don't have to speculate about Israel. Wherever you come from, I'm sure it's true in your hometown.
But wouldn't the fruits of peace be more important than just these territories for Israel in general?
Important in what respect?
Just in terms of wealth or anything.
Well, you know, you could say the same. Well, what is the advantage to Americans, you and me, people here, of spending, half of the disposable part of the budget on the military? Wouldn't we be better off if we didn't do that and we put it into medical care? Well, who'd be better off? People who get medical care would be better off, but the computer industry wouldn't be better off. I mean, these things are done for reasons. You know, they're not done. Policies are not undertaken because they benefit the population. That's why you don't have elections in which people participate. Well, we just went through a kind of a, what's called an election. But if you look closely, there were no issues. In fact, the most important fact about this election, which ought to strike any MIT student instantly, is that it came out a statistical tie. Now, if you pick any set of issues, pick them at random, you know, any set of issues you can imagine, and think of the probability that millions of people will end up in a statistical tie on that set of issues, it's minuscule. I mean, the only way a thing like that can happen is if people are voting for, let's say, who should be the next president of Mars or something like that. Then it'll come out 50-50. But if there's anything at stake, it can't possibly come out 50-50. And it was, in fact, a tie, you know, which tells you right off there's only one plausible model for it. People were, you know, voting for something that they regarded as irrelevant. You know, the this guy has a nice smile, or this guy looks too arrogant, or something like that. And that's the overwhelming fact, meaning there wasn't an election, period. 6 weeks have been spent in massive commentary by everyone from law professors to journalists trying to persuade us that there was an election and that it mattered what technical device you pick to resolve a statistical tie. And the answer is it doesn't matter. You know, the easiest thing would be flip a coin if it's a statistical tie, and it was meaningless in the first place. But then it would be obvious that there was no election. But if we don't, but that's, you know, this is part of the way of marginalizing the public. The policy is not made for the benefit of the public. So your questions are correct, but they go deep into the nature of what's called functioning democracy, and they're right as true here as they are in Israel.
We actually do have to close.
Yeah.
Just to be fair, we will take your last question. But you must
Okay, hopefully this will be short.
I'll have to be quick. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about the, or briefly talk about the true relationship of the Christian Lebanese and the SLA and the influence in the area.
Well, that's a long, complicated story. I think probably not. The SLA is a mercenary force. It was partly Christian, partly Shiite. It was a mercenary force created by Israel to occupy this southern region. They drove out a huge number of people, and these were the people who somehow survived by collaborating. As soon as Israel withdrew, they just disappeared. You know? It's like other mercenary armies that have been established to try to control the population. They're okay as long as the ruling power is there. I mean, just ask yourself, what happened to the black mercenaries in the Bantustans after apartheid broke down? You don't hear anything about them anymore. I mean, if people were kind, they didn't get murdered and got absorbed back into the society.
Just out of curiosity, did the Christians invite the Israeli invasion of 1982 or not?
No. The Christians, the Maronites, first of all, there are many different Christians. The Maronites, which is a separate group, were in favor of the Israeli invasion, and there's a long Maronite-Israel connection that goes back to the 1940s. I mean, for, you know, Ben-Gurion had this idea of a Maronite state that would be an ally of Israel, and it's all kind of crazy stuff. And the Maronites hoped that these, and Israel intended, in fact, to impose a Maronite regime, a right-wing Maronite regime, on Lebanon. That was one of the goals of the invasion. That fell apart pretty fast, and, you know. But the internal politics of Lebanon are, you know, a horrendous mess. It's cut all sorts of ways. The original Syrian intervention in Lebanon back in 1976 was at the, you know, with the backing of the United States and Israel, because they were going to attack Palestinians, which they did. You really look into it, it's an awfully complicated story, an unpleasant story, I'm afraid.
Okay, can we do one?
All right, go ahead. I'll try to be brief. Yeah.
In your lecture, Professor Chomsky, you didn't relate directly to Zionism and to the fact that it actually established a system of apartheid, not for the last 50 years, I mean, from the establishment of the State of Israel, but for the last 100 years, and situation in which rights are given by origin, by blood, by ethnic affiliation, and not
You're right, but could you get to the question?
Not all the Americans know that civil rights are not assured to all the citizens, but according to origin and blood. And what is your relation to the idea of one secular democratic state in Palestine, which may be the only reasonable solution?
Well, if anybody were in favor of a secular democratic state, I think it would be a good idea, but nobody's in favor of it. The PLO talked about it for years, but they didn't believe a word they were saying. When you looked at the PLO documents of the 1970s about a democratic secular state, what they meant was, and if you look at the footnotes, they spelled it out, an Arab state, in fact, an Arab religious state, in which Jews would be granted a temporary right as a religious minority. That's not a democratic secular state. This was just lies. A democratic secular state is a nice idea, but, you know, there are very few in the world. Israel was founded pretty much on the European model, which is different from the U.S. model. The European model is one of essentially nation states. You know, so the state is owned by a nation, and other people are kind of marginal to the nation. And it's not a pretty system. I mean, it took Europe 500 years of mutual massacre and murder to establish that horrible system. They're now slightly beginning to extricate themselves from it. The European imperialism tried to impose it on the rest of the world with horrifying results. I mean, a lot of the awful conflicts going on around the world are the effect of, you know, the effort to try to deal with the legacy of the European nation state system that was imposed on parts of the world where it makes no sense. In fact, the Middle East is a good example. I mean, the Ottoman Empire wasn't the most beautiful thing in the world, but it was attuned to the realities of the Middle East in a way that nothing since has been. I mean, under the Ottoman Empire, there was a corrupt, you know, ruler. There were corrupt rulers in Turkey who fortunately were so corrupt that they didn't know what was going on most of the time, which is a good thing. But they kind of left, you know, groups alone. You know, so there's a lot of local autonomy for religious groups, ethnic groups, and so on. And that actually fits the character of the region. It was very free. You could travel anywhere. You could travel throughout the Ottoman Empire. You didn't have to cross a customs booth, you know, go anywhere you like. I mean, I'm not suggesting it was a pretty system. It wasn't. It was ugly. But it had a certain realism about it. And ultimately, I think that's the kind of realism that should exist in Europe and the Middle East and other places. But to try to construct it is extremely hard.
Thank you, Professor Chomsky, and thank you all for coming today, staying so long. If you'd like to get more information on what action is going on grassroots here, go on the back of Kresge, and there's some tables with some flyers. And thanks again for coming.